It works after a while.
Yeah.
It's just watching.
Yeah.
I think that's...
Yeah, it seems to be going now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Mr. Luke, where were your parents from?
Well, my parents were from China, from Toisan, or that general area, Toisan or Sunning.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the name, the area, the Chung Lao, and we were at Yenon Tun,
mm-hmm.
the village of Yenon Tun. I suppose that means what, the peaceful people, happy people, whatever, village.
Mm-hmm. And when did your parents come to the States?
Oh, my father was over here, I think in the late 1800s, and he was in San Francisco. And he was in business there, importing, exporting, and so forth. And he went back to China to be married, and I was born in China. And then later on, he came back and he brought us over here, mother and me, to Seattle, Washington. That was in 1907.
And when were you born?
I was born in 1904,
mm-hmm.
in the month of June.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
June 18th, as a matter of fact. So I suppose I'm a Gemini in the Western calendar.
Uh-huh.
And in the Chinese calendar, I was born on, it was the day of the Dragon Festival. When was that? May, sometime in May, I think. Palungju, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know that, that they have those dragon boat races and
mm-hmm.
all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, what did your father do when he came to
Seattle?
Seattle.
Well, he moved his business up from San Francisco to Seattle, and he was in business with a very well-known Chinese up in Seattle, Mak Tin Sui, I think his name was. Mak Tin Sui was a very colorful figure, always dressed stylishly and all that. And spoke good English, and my father also spoke good English. So he was bilingual, and so was Mak Tin Sui, and together they had this store up in Seattle, Washington.
Where did your father learn his English?
Well, I think he learned it with the missionaries and Sunday school. Go to Sunday school in the evenings and all. I think that's how he picked it up and learned it.
Mm-hmm. This importing and exporting business was what kinds of goods?
Well, it was the usual oriental things, expensive objects of art, but things along that line, porcelains, dishes, various other things, household utensils, furniture, etc.
Mm-hmm. And how long did he remain in that business?
Oh, he stayed in that business for years, until about 19, I think it was 12, when he took the entire family. By that time, we had, there were three boys and one daughter. And he took us back to China for a visit. And we were back in China for about, I think it was a year and a half. We lived in Hong Kong, we lived in Canton. As a matter of fact, in Hong Kong and Canton, I think we lived in the newly fashionable apartment houses and so forth. I think they call them Bak Mon, you know,
uh-huh.
100 doors or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is. And then we went back to the ancestral village and lived there for a while. And I remember that some of my most vivid recollections of the trip I got at that time. We lived in the village, and I participated in rice harvests, you know, and I brought water in from the well, and I gathered firewood, and I sat up in the guardhouse with the men who were keeping watch at night because there were brigands roving around in those days. So, and I remember the marvelous fruits in China, the flavor of the fruits, the mangoes, the bananas, the lychees, and the dragon's eyes, Lungan, or whatever they call those. And it was really very memorable. And I remember, so many things about China. The bamboo groves I used to sit under, you know, for shade and watch the white herons fly out of them and so on. And the and the rides that we used to take on the steamer going down to Canton from where we were, passing banana groves, and you could smell that vanilla smell of the bananas, you know, for miles down the river as you pass down the river, and so on. And I remember also the Chinese opera. Very vivid memories of that. Father used to take us to, and of course it was all night affair. You know, you go in the evening, have dinner, and all that, and the opera begins and just goes on and on and on and on. You fall asleep, you wake up again, you go out, get something to eat, come back in, all that. It was fascinating, really fascinating.
You were about 8 or 9 years old.
I was about, let me see now, that was about 1912. I was born in 1912. Yeah, about 9 years old.
And how about your other brothers? Well, how old were they?
The next one to me is 4 years younger. So he was about, I remember it was about 10, I was 10 years old when we came back, I think. And he was about 6, I was 4 years older. My sister was 5. And then my other brother, it was, I remember he was still crawling around on his hands and knees, you know, wearing diapers.
Why did your parents decide to go back to China for a year?
Well, I guess it was the call of the old fatherland sort of thing, the homesickness, you know. And father thought he'd like to take us back and let us take a look. Of course, I was the only one old enough to appreciate it, you see, and so on. But he kind of felt that it was something that he should do. So then, of course, we came back just before the European War broke out, the First World War. And they cautioned us on the crossing of the Pacific to watch out for German submarines. Mm.
Did you go to Chinese school?
Yes, I went to Chinese school in Seattle. I went
But when you were in China, right?
Oh,
in
no,
Hong
not,
Kong,
not, not
did
China.
You go to
no,
school
no,
at all?
No, 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 I didn't go. I remember the kids always used to call us Kim San Hak, you know, or what is it, tourists from China, you know. I mean, from the United States. United States tourists, American tourists. And they said, you look at those funny shoes you're wearing, and those funny knickers you're wearing, and, you know, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What did your parents do during that year and a half? Just
well, they just
visited,
that was all. Just what anyone would do on a visit, get together with relatives, and so on. He probably made some business contacts. I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. So, and then what did your father do after?
Well, he came back here to Seattle, and he went into the same business, but from that time on, however, he didn't stay long in it. From that time on, he began to move around a little bit. We moved even back to Battle Creek, Michigan, if you can believe that. And I remember going to number one public school there, and remember being shown through the Kellogg plant, you know. And we were given all sorts of things at the plant, and candies and boxes of this, that, or the other thing, so forth. And then we came back from Battle Creek, and
what was he doing in
Battle Creek? Let me see, what was he doing there? Oh yes, I think I had an uncle of mine who had a big restaurant there, and my father was in the restaurant business with my uncle. Then he left that, and we all moved out to Chicago, I think. And in Chicago, there was another relative that had a restaurant, so father was with him for a while. And then we finally came back to Seattle and settled down. And he opened up another export and import store.
When was that that you actually
Well,
came
now
back
let's
to
see.
Seattle?
That was about 1915 or so.
But you came back to Seattle?
Yeah, from the east. Mm-hmm. About either 1915 or 1916. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And your father stayed in the same
business?
Retired?
Yeah, so well, he had moved a couple of locations, but he was back in the same business again.
Mm-hmm. And so, how did you end up in Los Angeles?
Well, I had my schooling in Seattle, went to grammar school there, the Pacific Grammar School, I can still remember the name of it. And it was our proud boast at the school that we had the lieutenant governor of the state of Washington. He was a former student. I think his name was Coyle. We used to call him Wee Coyle, because he was so small, but he was a very fine athlete and was a star football player at the University of Washington. We were very proud of him. And so I went through grammar school there, and then I went to Franklin High School
in
Seattle.
In Seattle.
Yeah, I took the art course there. So I had a rather well-developed art talent, and after I got out of high school, I wanted to go to New York and study at the Art Students League, and then eventually go to Paris and start and all that. You know, it was a dream of all young aspiring artists in those days, because I never got there. But anyway, my father died.
And when was
that? He passed away. That was in 1923. So in Chinese families, when you're the oldest son, you immediately take over the, you know, the leadership of the family. So I naturally, you know, we had to have an income. So I went around looking for work, and I took my portfolio, drawings and so forth, around, and I wound up at the Columbia Theater in Seattle. That was one of the big theaters there on Second Avenue. And it was owned by Universal Studios, Hollywood here, and it's part of the Northwest chain of theaters. And I met their exploitation and advertising man, who just happened to be in town that week. He was up there from Hollywood, and he was supervising the changing of the program. It was a sudden change. Theaters often do that. They'll pull a picture and put another one in, so on. So that's what he was engaged in doing, and he didn't have any artwork to advertise the new picture with, so I happened to drop in. He had just come back from China not too long ago, where he had taken the only Chinese aviator in the world, barnstorming throughout the country, and so on. So naturally, he was very fond of things Chinese and so on, so we hit it off right away. His name was Mike Newman. Mm-hmm. So Mike and I hit it off very well, and so he said, "Now look, I need this artwork." He says, "When can you have it?" I said, "Well, when do you want it?" He said, "It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon." Then he said, "Oh, tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock here, the newspaper is going to come and pick it up, pick the drawing up, advertise it." I said, "You'll have it." So he didn't have any stills, you see, because it was such a sudden move. But he did have a small photograph of Madge Bellamy, who was then a big star, and it was a circus picture. And he wanted me to put a figure on her, put her head on top of a figure sitting on top of a big elephant, you know. So nothing to work with, but I, as I said, I could draw pretty well, so I put the whole thing together for him, and the next morning he liked it. He said, "Well, this is done to the Queen's taste." So I didn't know it, but from that moment on, I was in the entertainment business. So I continued to do work for the theater, and then for the Columbia Theater. Then I also did work for the Paramount, the Publix Theater, which was another huge chain. They built the biggest theater in Seattle there. At Fifth Avenue, near the Olympic Hotel, which was the big hotel in those days. And I did artwork for them, and our proud advertising slogan was that we had an acre of seats in a palace of splendor. You know, all these big, super colossal publicity blurbs that we used to get out in those days. So then I eventually came down here to Hollywood. I thought, well, it's time I look for greener pastures. So I had some friends who were living down here, but who had a summer home in Seattle on the lake up there, a boat. And I knew them because they were in the art circles, and he happened to be a writer for Charlie Chaplin. So he says, "Oh, come on down to Hollywood. That's where the action is," you know, and so forth. So I did, and I came down here, and I stayed with them and so on. And I found work, not in motion pictures then. I found work doing advertising artwork for Sears Roebuck. I used to draw a lot of things for their catalogs. So then I got a call from Seattle to go back and do some murals, some Chinese murals, for a dining room for one of the big department stores, a brand new department store. They wanted a Chinese motif, scenes from Chinese mythology and all that. So I painted a series of about, I think it was 6 panels on canvas and so forth for their wall decorations. Then I came back here and I went to work for Grauman's Chinese Theater. The thought was that since it was a Chinese theater, they ought to have a Chinese artist, you see. So anyway, I went to work for them under the aegis of the Fox West Coast Theaters that control the entire chain of theaters, you see, of which Grauman's Theater was one. So
and
through
when did you come to Hollywood?
In 1927. Yeah, and then I returned here for good in 1929. And so 1929, I was with the Grauman's Chinese Theater, and I did artwork for all the different pictures from the different studios, because, as I said, the Fox chain used them in their theaters, you see. They showed all these pictures. So while I was at Fox, I met everybody. You know, I used to pose stars for publicity pictures, and I made portraits of them, all this sort of thing, designed layouts and newspaper campaigns, billboards, etc., and giveaway programs at the premieres that they used to give. So I moved on from Fox to RKO Theater for the simple reason that, not RKO Theaters, but RKO Studios, for the simple reason that they offered me some more money. So I changed studios, I changed from Fox to RKO. And there, we were doing the first Astaire Rogers picture, Flying Down to Rio. And I did a lot of artwork on that. So the producer said, the next one I'm going to do with Fred and Ginger will be Ho for Shanghai, in which he says, I'll use Anna Mae Wong, and I want you to play her romantic lead. I said, look, I'm an artist, and so on. But he said, it's all right. He says, you've been around in this business. You know, it goes on, so forth. He said, I'll put you into a couple of shorts and give you some experience, and we'll go from there. So meanwhile, my friends in the newspapers, like Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper and all, Jimmy Starr, all the big syndicate writers for newspaper chains, played it up, you know. Chinese actor, Chinese artist, now turning actor, and so on and so forth. So they gave me marvelous publicity on it. And so all of a sudden, I was an actor. So that's the way it goes. I mean, I could go on like this from one thing to the other, you know, but I was probably one of the first Orientals to enter the mainstream. And I was a publicity artist, or what they call, what in those days, white collar job, or whatever the term was. And I think the only other person that I knew of at that time who was in the studios was James Wong Howe, you know, who subsequently became one of the great cameramen. And Anna Mae Wong was in the pictures then, but she was mainly in England and on the continent. She didn't do too much work here in Hollywood after her first start. And there may have been one or two other Orientals that were employed as technicians or something, but I don't remember. I may be doing somebody an injustice, but I think that Jimmy Howe and I, and then a little later, Tyrus Wong, as an artist, as a scenic artist. So the three of us were probably the first Orientals to really be employed by Hollywood studios in a bona fide job, you know, position.
Did you know James Wong Howe very well?
Well, I knew Jimmy fairly well, yes. Not too well, because he was always very busy and all that, much busier than I was, and so on and so forth. But we'd have dinner once in a while, and I'd visit him, chat, so on and so forth. But I didn't know him too well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did know him well, in that through, over 34 years or so, we saw each other now and then, so we really could say that we did know each other well, you know. I was familiar with his career, what he did, he was familiar with mine, and so on. But as for being around all the time, no.
Mm-hmm. So you did star in this movie?
No, we didn't. It's one of those things that happens in Hollywood all the time. The producer got fired, and someone else took over, and he had his own ideas as to what Astaire and Rogers should do next. But anyway, that served to launch me as an actor, you see. So, because the next thing I did do, I was in the Greta Garbo picture out of MGM.
What picture was that?
That was the Painted Veil. Greta Garbo, Herbert Marshall, George Brent, and Warner Olin, who was subsequently to be my father as Charlie Chan. I didn't know it then, but I was going to wind up working with him. So let's stop that for a minute now.
What was your father's name?
Lee. L-E-E. Lee Luke.
Lee Luke. Yeah. And your mother's name?
My mother was Deng Xu. Mm-hmm. She's from the Deng family.
Uh-huh. And your parents had five children altogether?
Yeah. Well, I think there was a sister before me, but she died of pneumonia when she was a small child in China. Mm-hmm. And then I think there was also a child after my sister Alice, but I think it was stillborn. Mm-hmm. So, five surviving children.
Did your mother work?
No. Oh, no. No, my mother came from a what we call a scholar's family. And she had the traditional bound feet, you know, which is characteristic of the so-called upper classes. And her father taught the classics when he was 16. So he was a very, very fine scholar. And she used to tell of how, you know, girls weren't permitted to study in those days. She used to tell her how whenever class was in session, she would get as close to the classroom as possible and hear what was going on, you know, and learn that way. A lot of things.
Was your mother from Canton area, too?
Yes, yes. See, the Lukes originally, as I understand it, started from the entrance of a commander by the name of the Luke family from up north. It seems that down south at that time, around Canton and so on, the place was more or less unsettled and was undecided whether to accept Chinese rule or not, you see, and so forth. So several expeditions sent against these unruly southerners had proved to be unsuccessful. So they finally sent this ancestor of mine, Luke, down. And he was a man of very persuasive speech and all that sort of thing, and quite a diplomat, evidently, because he converted these southerners to accept the Chinese rule. And he did it without using force, you see. So he was naturally rewarded by the government. And but he decided he liked the South there, and he decided he'd stay. And so that's how this the Luke clan to which I belong got started. And they proliferated and all that sort of thing down there. And then some of them got to Hawaii. And so I don't know who they are or anything, you know, although I do know I have a cousin over there, K.J. Luke, who happens to own a bank and a few other things. But that's roughly the Luke family, how we came into being, how we got over here and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Did you speak Chinese in your family?
Yes,
your
spoke Chinese, yeah.
Even when you, after you came back to the States?
Oh, yes, we spoke Cantonese, you know. And it's very ironic, you know, I've been studying Mandarin, and my Mandarin is more correct and grammatical and everything, because I'm learning it from with a book, you see. Whereas my Cantonese, I speak it without thinking, but if you were asked me to write it down, see, I would have difficulty. You see, because I never learned it in class, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I just spoke at home. You hear it, and you say it. You know, one of those things.
Mm-hmm. Did you marry?
Yes, I was married. My wife passed away just this last month, and yes, we've married since 1942.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any children?
Yeah, with two children by her former marriage. And of course, they're married, and their children are married. So I've got great great grandchildren. One of those things. Mm-hmm.
Did you speak Chinese with your family, with your wife and you?
No, my wife was French and Irish, but they read up on Chinese culture and so on and so forth. They love Chinese food, and nobody had to teach them how to use chopsticks. They just knew how, and so on. So, my wife's daughter has two daughters. One is at Ohio State, where she is the youngest member on the faculty board, and she's professor of English back there. And then the other daughter's married, living up in Oregon. And then my stepson's children, the daughter is a very successful commercial artist in San Francisco. She designs things for
department stores, and they released them, and she gets royalties and all that. Done very well. And the son, Johnny, he's in the State Department in Washington, D.C. He's in the economics department. And so all the kids are, you know, done well and so forth. And we hope that the great-grandchildren will do as well as their parents.
Mm-hmm. What was your wife's name?
Ethel.
Ethel?
Yeah.
Did she work at all?
No. Well, of course, years ago she did work, but she was a very, very fine accountant. And back in the old days, she still holds the world's record on the computing machines, manually operated. She could add up figures and all that sort of thing faster than anybody. And then, of course, when she was here in Hollywood, years ago she did some work for studios in story analysis and synopsis writing, recommending vehicles for various stars and so forth. But after we were married, she didn't do that anymore. So,
in your family, did your father and mother use yak toy at all?
Oh yes, they. Mother, you know, when we had a cold, she'd come up with some Chinese herbs and brew them, you know, and we'd drink and so forth, buyi cha, or for one thing. And then she used to give us something that was very effective, and I know why now. She used to give us those guiyiu, they call it, guiyiu. It was an oil, so it came in a little small little bottle with a red label, and had smelled like camphor and eucalyptus and so forth, and you know what was in it? Ephedrine. See, ephedrine is a drug that has been known to mankind since the old Egyptians and the old Chinese for nasal afflictions. Ephedrine was found to be they still use it today. Nothing is better for colds, for congestion, etc. And that was what it was, ephedrine. So I remember she used to give us this. We'd put it up our nose, and my golly, you know. Made all the difference in the world. It cleared the head, and you could breathe, and relieve the congestion.
But so the children went along with the
oh yes,
the herbs
yeah, we went along with it, yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, I do believe that a lot of those herbs have great medicinal value. You know, so we never fought it. We went along with it, and undoubtedly, it helped a lot.
Did you use any Chinese medicine with your family?
No, we didn't. No, we didn't. We just simply had a cold, went to the doctor. Well, the doctors use ephedrine, so. but no, we.
Do you ever use any Chinese herbs in cooking?
Well, I do some cooking once in a while, a Chinese dish or two, and so on. And so I use. No, I don't use too many. No, I don't use too many. Because, you know, you almost get the same effect. You're using peanut oil, soy sauce, onions, green onions, you know, black bean paste, things like that. You know, that's pretty standard. Mm-hmm. But for some of the more exotic dishes where you would put certain herbs and so forth, I don't cook in such a fancy manner that I would employ those.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to your education, you mentioned that you went to Chinese school. Was that in Seattle?
Yeah, Seattle. We had a Chinese school in Seattle, and all the kids would go in the evening. After American school in the afternoon, you'd go home and you'd dinner, whatever, and then at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, you'd go to Chinese school, study till about, 9 or whatever it may be, you know, and so on. So I went for about, I think it was about 6 years or so. And I can't honestly say that I really applied myself too much. What I actually did accomplish was that I learned to write pretty well because of my art ability. I became a fair, you know, calligrapher, and also I picked up other things too. But it was mainly in calligraphy that I excelled. The rest I have forgotten because. Well, I had a feeling that, well, after all, I'm in the United States, and this, if I learn this, is only a secondary language, you know, English is more important, so naturally I concentrated on English and spent most of my energies in English.
Did your parents force you to go to Chinese school?
No, they didn't force. They just simply, it just seemed to be a matter of course, you just did it. You know, because they had a teacher come over from China and everything like that, you know, and to go to Chinese school was a normal proceedings. Of course, some kids didn't go, but that was their own choice to stay out, or their parents didn't believe in it, or they didn't have the opportunity, I don't know. But most of the Chinese kids in the community that I knew went to the Chinese school. Of course, different grades, you know, the smaller ones up to advanced. You know, we have also had some advanced students, but they were mainly young men and women who were born in China and had studied there and just continuing their studies over here, you see.
Was 6 years the maximum number of years?
No,
you could
go there longer. Eighth grade, I think I used to bak ban or whatever they call it, you know, and so on. And then, of course, the advanced ones.
Why did you stop after six?
Well, I stopped because I got to the point where the high school and so forth was taking up, demanded more and more of my time. The subjects I was taking, requiring homework, etc., etc. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I finally had to make a choice, and I just dropped out of the Chinese school.
How about your sister and sisters?
Yes,
and other brothers?
Yes, she went. They all went. They all went. Jean, Dorothy, and Edward. Alice never did, but Alice was sort of on the invalid side, and so she never got around, you know, as much as the rest of us did. But Eddie, Jean, and Dorothy and I, we were all in attendance. You know.
Mm-hmm. What lines of work did some of your other brothers and sisters get into?
Well, my brother, Jean, finished high school in Seattle, and he went to work for a drugstore and became the buyer, you know, bought for the drugstore, for the chain of drugstores. And he decided he had enough of that, so he went back to college, he went to Berkeley, and he entered the dental school. And by special dispensation of the dean, they said, look, Mr. Luke, you're at your age, you know, he had already had a family, two kids and growing up and all that. Said, why would you want to do this and have to make up all these credits and everything? Well, he said, I want to be a dentist and so on and so forth. So the dean said, well, all right, I'll make an exception in the rule. So he passed with, I think, the highest honors in enamel work or whatever they call it, and he was the third highest in the entire class. So he came down here, and he opened his offices here, and then he moved to Long Beach, where he located permanently. And he got to the point where he had so darn much work, he couldn't turn around.
Is he still in Long Beach now?
No, he's passed on. He had a heart attack. Mm-hmm.
When his office was in L.A., was it in Chinatown?
No. When he was in L.A., when he was living in L.A., he was really working for the county some clinic, health service clinic or something like that. Then he went to Long Beach and opened his own office, took in a partner, an assistant, and so forth. And he also became one of the best golfers in the Oriental community here. He was a tournament player. He was that good. But he had a heart attack and passed away. Then my sister, Dorothy, went to work for a big department store in Seattle and became buyer of cosmetics for the store. And then she later went to San Francisco after she got married. And she was associated with Revlon when they were just beginning to come up. So she was with Revlon for many successful years. And she's given that up now. And Edwin finished the University of Washington School of Journalism and came down here. And I got him a job with the Hollywood Reporter. He started from the ground up as a printer's devil, you know. And from there, through the years, 25 years or more, he rose to be the printer, the charge of the shop, and everything like that. And then he finally had enough of that, so he gave it up and went into social service work here. And he was just retired a year or so ago. after you become a district supervisor or whatever they call them. So that's the...
He's still in Los Angeles?
Yeah, he's still, he's retired out.
And Dorothy, is she still in LA?
She's in San Francisco, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he has passed on. So...
And Alice?
Alice is married, and she's living in San Mateo. And her husband's in the restaurant business. She's not well. She hasn't been well for all her life long. But somehow, she's pretty rugged. She hangs on, mm-hmm. has her ups and downs. Mm-hmm. So the kids that were able all sort of made it, you know.
Mm. Yeah. Did your father come to the States with the intention of, you know, ultimately returning to China?
Well, that seemed to be the common procedure in those days. They go to Gimsan, you know, to the mountain of gold, and they make their fortune there, and then they go back to the old the homeland and live out their days in peace and contentment, etc., etc., you know. And that seemed to be the pattern, because a lot of them, good many of them, never made it. Because once they got over here, they got caught up in this, that, and the other thing, so forth, and so on. And but some of them did make it and go back, you know. But I would say that the greater percentage never did. Because after all, you know, they come over here and they get the roots sunk here. And there it is.
Do you think that's what happened to your father? That's
yes, to a degree, mm-hmm. I think. And also the fact that around about that time, you know, there was the Chinese Revolution was going on, you know, around 1912 and 11. And China was not in a very, very settled condition. So I think that influenced him a great deal.
How old was he when he died?
Oh, he was only, his father was only about 47.
Mm.
Yeah. 47.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did he send money regularly back to family?
Yeah, when we were
China?
There, when my mother and I were there, yes. You know, but then he went back to China and brought us over, you see, in 1907. So he wasn't sending any money back from that time on, maybe to other relatives. But we were already, they were then here with him.
Mm-hmm. And did your parents correspond with family relatives back in China?
Yes, my father did, I know. You see, I was only 19 when he passed away. And it's one of the regrettable things in my life is that I never really didn't know my father, didn't get to know him better than I did. He was busy, and I was... kids busy with schoolwork and this, that, and the other thing, and your own little circle of friends, and so whenever you got together, it was at dinner time, maybe, and then most of the time we ate at home, he was at the store, you know, and so on. So I really never got to know my father the way an average child would know his father, and so that's one of my regrets. But I know that that was what influenced him to stay on over here. And then, too, as I say, a bunch of children are born here, they go to school here, they're growing up here. It's not easy to say, okay, let's pack up and go, you know, say, and so forth. So that was one thing I realized early. You see, after he passed away, I became the head of the house. So, I mean, that's ridiculous, you know. I mean, a kid who knows absolutely nothing about life. So anyway, I remember the elders all got together, you know, to talk about, well, what to do with the family? What to do with the family? Well, all right, let's do this. Key and Eugene, the two oldest, stay here and work. And the mother and the two daughters and the youngest boy back to the ancestral village where they will stay, and Key and Gene will work here and send money back to support them. That's the classical. So, in one of the key decisions of my life, which fortunately has turned out beautifully, I said to them, no. I said, we're not going back. No one's going back to China. I said, we just see where the kids had saved up some money in a savings account, and we had bought a new home, and that was a big morale builder, you know, new way. And home here. I said, the kids were all born here. I said, their friends are here, their schooling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I said, I'm not going back. And so, since the head of the family had spoken, the elders all acquiesced, bowed to my decision and judgment. And so that was that. We stayed. And of course, as I said, it's all turned out beautiful. You know, everyone went to work, pulled himself up by the bootstrap, we all helped each other, and so on. And it all worked out. I sent my brother through college, you know, to send home money, take care of this, that, the other thing, and so forth, and so on, and so forth. And then Gene went to work, and he helped out, and Dorothy went to work, she helped out, and because Eddie eventually came down here and went to work, he helped out, so.
You sent money back to China to relatives?
No, I didn't. Because actually, I knew vaguely that I had some relatives back there, but who they were, I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So all our energies were concentrated on surviving over here.
Mm-hmm. Did your mother take on a job at that
time? No, she mother never worked.
So she relied on you.
Yeah, we could cook. Every one of us could cook. We could do the washing, do the ironing, do the, everything like that. All she had to do was just sit there and
mm-hmm.
be boss of the whole outfit.
Mm. What kinds of things did you do for recreation when you were in Seattle?
We all played the usual things in school. We played ball, baseball. I remember at the time that I was in grammar school, we even had soccer, you know. We played soccer, and then we'd have our little sandlot teams where we'd play, you know, with other kids and so on. Then we had our basketball teams. We'd go to the district playground there and the gymnasium, and we'd all be put into teams and all that, and we'd play and all the championship or whatever and so on. So we had plenty of athletic recreation, swimming at the Y and, you know, and all that.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever engaged in any Chinese kind of activities, you know? Like listening to Chinese music or...
Well, that I did a little of it en passant, but mainly I studied Chinese art and philosophy.
Did you study that on your own?
On my own, and yes, mainly on my own. Because by that time I was out of school, high school. I entered the University of Washington as an architecture student, because my father said, as a painter, he says, you know, all artists are starving to death these days, and so... Why don't you turn your art talent to something practical like architecture, you know? So I went along with him. But he died just about then, and so I had to drop out and go to work. And that was where, of course, the Columbia Theater came in, you see,
mm-hmm.
and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I've studied, followed the Chinese art and philosophy down through the years, and my own drawings have a definite Chinese traditional quality to them, and so on.
Did your parents send you to art school at all?
No. Oh, while I was in Seattle, I did go to art school, but I did it with my own money, you know, selling papers or something or the other. Where I was a member of the Seattle Art Club, and I got some very good instruction there, and so forth. Then when I came down here to work for Fox and so on, I spent some time studying at the Chouinard Art Institute here, and so on. And I belong to the California Art Club. Exhibit a lot of the drawings around and so on. So that was it.
So your community in Seattle was pretty much non-Chinese?
Yeah, well, we didn't live in Chinatown, let's put it that way. We had our own homes. Of course, many Chinese families did not live in Chinatown then. A good many did. But a good many also did not. So it wasn't like a ghetto where every Chinese was in there and nowhere else, you know, that sort of thing. We had a lot of freedom of movement and everything like that, and there was this thing called desegregation today and so on, but nobody ever dreamed of it.
Mm-hmm. Did you associate mostly with Chinese or?
Well, yes, we had Chinese and non-Chinese. My friends were all mixed, you know. I had Chinese friends, I had Japanese friends, I had some Filipino friends, and then the rest were sort of Caucasian, you know, and so in school we all go to shows together, or we play together, or whatever. It was a very, very natural, easy community where everybody got along.